So thank you all for coming to the second part of the Harav, the Rav, and Rebbe Chabura. Last week we just gave a general introduction about how each of these three figures was able to create a Torah community that was a little bit different than the one they grew up in Europe, and how part of it was sociology, demographics, changes in time and place, and part of it was ideology. They all described their own machshava, their own ideology, as somewhat new. So today, I just want to go through the basics of what the Rav says his own methodology in Jewish philosophy is. Then we'll get to Rav Kook and the Rebbe in different shirim. Just to note, we're going to be focusing on the book Halachic Mind for today, and then for the next 25 minutes or so. Halachic Mind, the Rav wrote in the 40s. I think he says he wrote it in 1944. He only published it in 1985, but he said in the foreword that he didn't change anything from the 1944 original writing. The Halachic Mind is probably the most difficult book to read from Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's you really have to be holding in Western philosophy from the Greeks down to contemporary times from the 1940s to understand what the world's going on. I honestly, my first time through it, did not understand what the world was going on, but I was lucky enough, and I still don't understand what's going on in some passages and some of the quotes, but I was lucky enough to, take a class with Dr. Reinold, who was very well versed in general philosophy and got his PhD in the writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik. I had a couple conversations with Rabbi Carmi, who also understands these things. And there are two very good reviews of the book. One of them is from Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, which I'll be quoting from today. He also has a doctorate in general philosophy and well versed in Jewish philosophy, so he's a good person to write a review. And this guy, Dr. William Kohlbrenner, who's in the process of writing a book, publishing a book about the writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and also I think he's a philosopher by trade. He teaches philosophy somewhere. So and he also wrote a review of Halachic Mind. But first, just to look at the first source. This is from Rabbi Jonathan Sachs's review of Halachic Mind. First, he talks about what the Rav talks about in Halachic Man. He talks about what the topics in the Lonely Man of Faith, and source number one. It says the program of Halachic Mind is essentially prior to both of these enterprises. It's prior to Halachic Man and Lonely Man of Faith, the Rav's other books. In it, meaning in Halachic Mind, Rabbi Soloveitchik sets out his claim, number one, for the cognitive status of religion. That's one, the cognitive status of religion. Number two, for the methodological autonomy of the philosophy of religion. We'll describe exactly what that means. And number three, for the primacy of halacha as the basic datum from which a philosophy of Judaism should be based. So number one, religion needs cognition, systematic cognition. Number two, this cognition about religion should be autonomous, should be distinct from other forms of cognition, other forms of thought. And number three, halacha is the best data to use to formulate Jewish philosophy. This looks very much like the epistemological prologue to the other two works. This is the epistemology. This is the methodology that Rabbi Soloveitchik uses throughout his writings on Jewish philosophy. And people have written articles about the Rav Anavelos, Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Blitzstein, the Talmud of the Rav, who now teaches in Ben Gurion, wrote an article. If you read the Rav's Lumdus and then you read the Rav's philosophical writings about Anavelos, you see him using the methodology in Halachic Mind. People have written articles about Tefillah. We're going to give if there's time, we'll give a short example today about Shofar, but the Rav's philosophical writings, so to speak, about Shofar are using the methodology he develops in Halachic Mind. So the beginning of Halachic Mind, we're going to run through the parts which I sort of understand. The beginning of Halachic Mind tries to summarize the history of Western philosophy in two chapters. He goes through it, obviously, with a goal and agenda. He goes through what he thinks the salient points are. And he says the following. He says, great philosophical systems, source number two, are never produced in a scientific vacuum, but usually follow the formation and completion of a scientific world perspective. The priority of scientific knowledge to philosophical interpretation can be discerned twice in the history of philosophy. First, there was Italian natural sciences and metaphysics, which dominated Occidental thought throughout ancient and medieval times. And second, the Galilean Newtonian mathematical physics, which fostered philosophy of nature. Basically, what Rabbi Soloveitchik says, in short, is that throughout the history of Western philosophy, from the Greeks to the early 1900s, there was always a general framework within which philosophy was done. If you were living in Greco-Roman times, and if you went all the way through the Middle Ages, the terms, the boundaries, the contours of philosophical discourse were determined by Greek philosophy, by Aristotle, by Plato, by such people. That was the vogue. Those were the philosophers. And that was the single discourse that people used when you were trying to develop a philosophy. Great. So now let's take a step back. If you're a religious philosopher, you're a Jewish philosopher, you're somebody who is Jewish, Orthodox, learned the Torah, and you want to discuss Judaism from a philosophical perspective, So if you're living in such a venue, where there is a where everybody around you thinks that the basic contours of Aristotle's thought are right, the basic contours of the scientific revolution, whatever it is, are right, so what are you going to do? So for Salvechik says you have two options as to what you should do. Number one is to jump on the bandwagon and use the same terms, the same ideas that are just the objective truth, so to speak, from the outside world, and discuss your religion, your religious philosophy from that vantage point. Who's the primary example of somebody who does this in that the Rebbe Soloveitchik describes in Halachic Mind? The Rambam. He says if you go through the Rambam's Tamei HaMitzvos, it's not a Mishneh Torah, but if you go through what he says in Morning Book and the Contra Book of Acts, he says you'll find this over and over and over again. The Rambam obviously is very Jewish, and he's describing things in Jewish terms, but a lot of the terms he uses, a lot of the ideas he assumes, are coming from Greco-Roman philosophy or coming from Aristotle. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says that's why the Rambam ultimately failed. That's why when we think about mitzvos, we think about Tamei HaMitzvos, most of us don't jump to Morne Bukim. We jump to other books. Why don't we jump to Morne Bukim? Because this is not a good way of doing Jewish philosophy. The Rambam was sort of forced into it because Aristotelian philosophy was the be-all and end-all. So he wanted to describe Jewish Judaism in its terms, but it's not going to get you to a robust, meaningful Jewish philosophy. Look at source number 3, Halakha Halachic Mind. This is from the end of the book. So judging Maimonides' undertaking retrospectively, one must admit that the master whose thought shaped Jewish ideology for centuries did not succeed, making his interpretations of the commandments prevalent in our world perspective. We don't think about mitzvos in the way the Rambam thought about mitzvos in Morah Nevuchim. The reluctance on the part of the Jewish homo religiosus to accept Maimonidean rationalistic ideas are not ascribable to any agnostic tendencies, but to the incontrovertible fact that such explanations neither edify nor inspire the religious consciousness. They are essentially, if not entirely, valueless for the religious interest that we have most at heart. Very strong language from the Rav about the Rambam. Obviously, he's a big fan of the Rambam. The Rambam is also the hero, so to speak, of Halachic Mind, at least the Rambam in Mishneh Torah. But the Rambam in Morah Nevuchim is somebody who falls prey to what people have been falling prey to for thousands of years, which is describing Judaism within the context of some other thought system. So option number one, you have a dominant thought system, Aristotelian philosophy. All religious discourse, philosophism is within those terms. Rambam jumps on the bandwagon. What would another option for a Jewish religious philosopher be, or a Jewish religious person? Just to abandon the whole enterprise. If systematic thought, if people who are writing religious philosophical discourse are using Aristotelian terms, and that's so foreign to you, so you're just going to not systematically try to describe your religion. You're going to describe emotional outbursts. You're going to describe religious experience. You're going to give divrei Torah on the parsha, but you're not going to try to systematize the ideas, the basic ideas of Judaism. You have a sound?
Why would it be that it would be successful in shaping Jewish ideology, but not in the interpretations of the commandments?
Because Jewish ideology is, he says those things in the Rambam. He says, if I recall correctly, I didn't read through the book before I gave this. Those things the Rambam was just describing what Chazal said in different terms. Like those things the Rambam won out on. Tamei HaMitzvos, the Rambam did not win out on. So Yugim LiYikarim are thinking the things that are from Chazal. So those things the Rambam won out on. But Tamei HaMitzvos, the Rambam was very clearly saying new things. If you're going to explain all of Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara based on the fact that it's important to have Yiras Hashem, so we want to set up artificial boundaries so that if you have to go to the mikvah and go through a process in order to be able to go up to the Beis HaMikdash, so that it sort of takes the whole wind out of the whole system of Tumah V'Tahara, as opposed to explaining Tumah V'Tahara in a different way, which seems more powerful, so to speak, to the religious imagination. The other approach, as Soloveitchik says, is just to move away and try to not systematize the ideas of Jewish philosophy. Look at source number 4. As the homo religiosus moves in a concrete world full of color and sound. He lives in his immediate qualitative environment, not in a scientifically constructed cosmos. Hence, as long as cognition was the exclusive privilege of the scientist and of the philosopher who followed his traces, the homo religios saw even in other spheres. Just didn't try to systematize Jewish philosophy. So you have a lot of books about Divrei Torah and the Parsha, short words, short insights, very powerful, but not a systematic portrayal of the basic ideas of Judaism. I just came from a class in the Baba Trevi. Chabad says that the Tanya did this. The Tanya is not bound to the order of the parashos of the week. It's bound to a structure, to a principal system that he basically had, and he organized the book around the system of principles. The Rav says it wasn't done. So So what happened? This was from the beginning of Western thought until the early 1900s. What happened at the beginning of the early 1900s? The fact that there was one objective mode of thought that was the correct way to discuss philosophy broke down. Again, I have no idea of the Rav's evaluation of the history of Western philosophy is accurate or not accurate. I don't know, but this is what he says in the book. What happened? A couple things happened, he said. He said, number one is that the scientists started understanding that they can't always reach objective truths. It's people like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You can actually get a specific objective answer, an answer to a question. You have quantum mechanics, where there are two contradictory responses, two contradictory types of equations that are both accurately describing the same phenomenon. And he traces it with scientists and philosophers, mainly physicists and mathematicians, in the early 1900s, and says that what developed was this concept of epistemological pluralism. What's epistemological pluralism? It's exactly what it sounds like, that there are multiple epistemologies. That you have a physicist, you have a biologist, you have an English lit major, you have a psychologist, you have a politician. And they're all describing the same phenomenon. They're all giving different descriptions, different answers to the same question. And they're all equally valid because they're all coming at it from distinct epistemologies, distinct methodologies that are all true. And that's just the way God created the world, that there are different valid answers to the same question. The example that the Rav gives over here is time. Again, I don't fully understand what in the world he means by all these things, but if you look at source number six, does the category of time may serve as an illustration. It says the natural sciences attempt to convert time into quantitative chronometry, Bergson, or chronogeography. I don't know how to pronounce these words, Russell. Humanistic sciences conceive it as creative quality identifiable with the stream of consciousness, James, or pure duration, Bergson. Basically, what is time? You ask four different people in four different fields, you get four different answers. And that's where the state of philosophy and science was in the early, or was developing in the early 1900s. So what does Rav Soloveitchik say? Again, he said, remember if he said at the beginning, the first quote we had at the beginning of last week, that the 1940s is the best time to be a religious philosopher. Why? Because once each discipline is breaking apart from the superstructure, and each discipline is realizing that it has to develop its own autonomous, own distinct methodology and epistemology to come up with its own answers to the questions, so then the religious person finally has a third avenue. He doesn't have to jump on the bandwagon of general philosophy. He doesn't have to abandon systematic thought. The religious philosopher has the ability to do what everybody else is doing in the early 1940s, which is develop its own methodology, develop its own autonomous religious philosophy. In the same way that a humanist, a psychologist, a physicist are going to describe time in a certain way, a Jewish philosopher could give you a fully independent, autonomous, Jewish version of what time is. And if we ask people from six different disciplines, what is the basic definition of a human being? They'll give you six different answers. So too, a Jewish religious philosopher will be able to develop a separate, distinct Jewish religious answer to that question. And every meaningful question about life, the same way each other discipline is looking at it from its own methodology, Judaism also is going to have its own distinct voice to answer all these questions. The only next step is, what is that methodology? Granted, 1940s, we have the ability to develop our own autonomous Jewish philosophy. But what is the methodology to develop that own autonomous Jewish philosophy? How are we supposed to go about doing it? The Rav says, what's the model of how to develop a good research methodology? Look at the scientists. What do the scientists do? What's the first step of the scientific method? I don't know. Is this really the first step of the scientific method? Observation. You have to observe the data. Is that the first step? Maybe. I don't know. Sorry. But let's assume that's the first step of scientific method. The first thing a scientist does is he observes the data. So what is the data of the Jewish religion? Says, what is the data of the Jewish religion?
Halakha.
The facts that God gave us about the world are the Torah that God gave us. The objectification of the Torah that God gave us is the halakha. So the halakhic system becomes the basic data that God gave us from which we are supposed to develop our religious philosophy. If you look at Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, this is from the eulogy which I started quoting last week, says this is exactly what Rabbi Soloveitchik told him, and it's exactly the innovative aspect in terms of the religious methodology of Rabbi Soloveitchik. So source number seven, He says, and what he said was very simple and fundamental. Again, Rabbi Sachs was describing how Soloveitchik changed the nature of the American Jewish community, part of it because of leadership, charisma, and vision, and part of it, he said, was because of this distinct philosophy. One thing Rabbi Soloveitchik described to Rabbi Sachs as being the basic hallmark of his philosophy, it was very simple and fundamental, yet it had never been said before. He said, in the past, Jewish philosophy, Machshavat Yisrael, and Halakha were two different things. They were disconnected. In truth, he said, They are only one thing, and that one thing is halacha. The only way you can think Jewishly and construct the Jewish philosophy is out of halacha. He gave me one example, and he gave the example of Shabbos. He said Heschel wrote a very beautiful book called Sabbath, the Sanctuary, and Time. Great, a very beautiful book describing Shabbos. So what Rav Soloveitchik told Rabbi Sachs, what's missing in the book? Lamtes halachos, muksa, all the halachos of Shabbos. If you want to create a distinct Jewish philosophy about what the Jewish concept of X, Y, and Z is, you have to start with the data, the raw data that God gave us. The raw data that God gave us is not the way we feel about things, but halacha, and that is going to be level one. But halacha itself is not a religious philosophy. It doesn't tell you what Shabbos is. It tells you what you're supposed to do about Shabbos. So what do you have to do? First thing, this is already interpolating a little bit into halachic mind. The first thing to do is to do lamdas, is to take the basic data that God gave you and create a concept, create a construct. Now, the basic, take all the details of lamdas malachos and say the getter of malacha and Shabbos is X, Y, and Z, purely a halachic formulation. That's exactly what briskers do when they learn. They take a lot of random pieces of data, and you create a certain conceptual construct. Instead, this data points to a certain concept. Great, now I have a conceptual construct. The gather of malacha and Shabbos is X, Y, and Z. The gather of tefillah is X, Y, and Z. So that still doesn't speak about Jewish philosophy. So what do we do? Where do we get philosophy from? So Rabbi Soloveitchik said that this is also, he uses the scientist as a model to a degree, we don't have to go there, says this is the point where you go from the objective to the subjective. You have to start off the objective data God gave us, which is the halakha. But then, after you analyze the data and you've created your conceptual construct, you're allowed to ask the following question. Not, why did God create this? Why did God create Shabbos in this way? Because if you're asking why did God create Shabbos in that way, that's asking why did God create the data this way, which is like asking why is there gravity? It's a meaningless question. The question you have to ask is, now that I know that together, Malacha and Shabbos is X, Y, and Z, what religious significance does that have for me personally as I experience Shabbos? What is the meaning of that for me in terms of my own religious life? If you look at source number 9, this is from a public lecture Rabbi Soloveitchik gave, Man of Faith in the Modern World, transcriptions of lectures that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave from Avraham Bezdin. He goes through this in much simpler terms. He says there are three types of questions when we ask about any phenomenon. Why, this is source number 9, why probes motivations to establish why things are the way they are? How seeks explanations to how they function effectively? And what looks for interpretations to establish meaningfulness? Asking why God issues certain commandments is seeking to comprehend the unfathomable. In response to the question, why did God create the world? We should not say that he is kind and wanted to bestow goodness on the world, or that the king needs a kingdom. Who gave those answers?
Kabbalists.
Ramchal, exactly. This is straight out of all. He says it in Halachic Man as well. You can't say these things. And the very notion of need implies that he has insufficiency, which he is going to overcome. This is obviously untenable. The only acceptable answer is he willed it. The same thing he goes on to say applies to mitzvahs. He's talking about Parah Aduma here in particular. Why did God command Parah Aduma? Why did God create this very strange ritual where you have to do something in order to become tar? That's like asking why did God create gravity. It's a meaningless question. Ben, I just want to finish, and I'll take the question after, so that's okay. Sorry. Asking how for chukim is also nonsensical. How did the sprinkling of the watery ashes of the paraduma cleanse the ritually unclean? We willingly and reverentially accept the incomprehensible how, even as we dutifully embrace the unfathomable why. We don't understand how it works. We just know it works. Remaining is the third question, and this is going to be the point of religious philosophy, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, which inquires about the meaningfulness of particular mitzvot to the individual and society. This is a legitimate pursuit. Nay, it may even be meritorious to inquire, how can I integrate and assimilate this mitzvah into my religious consciousness and outlook, what thoughts and emotions should I feel when the Paraduma chapter is read in the synagogue? How can it help me achieve Dvekut, a greater closeness to God? So first you have to start off by analyzing the halakhos of Paraduma and understanding them conceptually, learning up the sugya. Level two was not asking why or how, but asking what meaning does this have for me when I think about or perform this mitzvah. And that answer, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, is entirely subjective. It's going to be within a range, because we're all dealing with the same basic data sets, we're all dealing with the same basic concepts, but the meaning for me is going to be different than the meaning for you, because me and you are different people. And that basically, if you go through a lot of Rabbi Soloveitchik's writing, not all of his writings, a lot of his writings, that's what he's doing. He's describing the religious life, he's describing the religious experiences of himself regarding this and this area of Jewish life. In his book about Tzedakah, it's worship of the heart. The introduction, he didn't write the book, but it's a series of lectures he gave at Rebel, I think. I think the introduction is like the introduction to the semester. He says that we're going to be analyzing the sugyos of tefillah, and then I'm going to be describing the way I experience tefillah. And the way I experience tefillah may not resonate with anybody else. But still, this is the way I experience tefillah, and I hope it helps out some people. If it doesn't resonate with anybody, then so be it. It's just going to be the way I experience tefillah. Whereas the first level analysis is going to be the same for everybody. It's going to be analyzing the sugyos. Next level question is, how does that translate into my religious life? How do I experience tefillah now that I know that this is the lumdus behind it? And you're going to find all over Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings. So this is in the beginning of the book, the beginning of the tefillah book. I give you an example over here about his description of what he describes as the Jewish attitude towards safety and security. He's very frequently is going to say, this is the way I interpret Judaism. It may not be the way you interpret Judaism, but this is my interpretation, the meaning I get out of the same facts which you have to analyze and come up with your own meaning for as well. Just one example, and then we'll see, and then very, very quickly, how this whole structure plays itself out in terms of shofar. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik from a public lecture he gave once about the Holocaust. He says, if you look at this is from Rabbi Yerkefet's book, the Rav, if you look at the middle of the top line, he says, a man has no security as an individual, as I've explained many times. If man has a big bank account, does it make him secure? He's not secure, because the vicissitudes of life are not only in the economic area. Today I can move my fingers, next day I cannot. Is this security? Who can secure me against illness? It is ridiculous when people speak about security. There's absolutely no security. For the Jew to claim security is equally incorrect. Right? A lot of people would say, bitachon, 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 trust everything's going to be good. Soloveitchik is not into that approach. We're talking, we're talking, and trust everything is going to be good. You constantly have to be worried about what's going to happen, to a degree. I say this for many reasons. First of all, this is the prevailing mood in Judaism. It's not pessimism. The Jew is never secure as a person. On the other hand, the Jew is an optimist. It is a combination. The Jew thinks in dialectical terms. The thesis is right, but the antithesis is also right. The thesis is right in that no one is secure. The antithesis is also right in that man should feel secure as far as possible. If you operate with a thesis and an antithesis, which is a dialectical thinking, then you do not operate with ultimates. You do not have to say either this or that. You can develop a new approach. Then he says as follows. My interpretation of Judaism is not objective. No person who interprets Judaism can be objective. Judaism is an experience. Experiences vary just as personalities vary. Therefore, my interpretation of Judaism is an outgrowth of my personality and my own experiences. He goes on to explain what it was like to live in Germany immediately prior to the Holocaust, and then to move away, and then for the Holocaust to happen in that community which he lived for a good number of years. So you see, the lack of security, everything was fine in Berlin for a while. All of a sudden, the Nazis came in, and then the Holocaust happened. But when he says that Judaism is an experience, interpretations vary just as experiences vary. That's all valid as long as everybody is grounded in the same objective facts, meaning the halakha. You can't just make up whatever you want about Shabbos, make up whatever you want about what the mood of Judaism is. You have to learn up the sugya, learn up the facts, develop a conceptual construct, and then ask yourself as a person, what does this mean for me in terms of my tefillah now that I understand the sugya of the tefillah? And as Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophical writings, by and large, are describing religious experiences that he has, the way Dr. Sachs refers to it, is religious phenomenology, describing the life of a religious person, based around the sugyos and based around the lumdas that Rabbi Soloveitchik got out of the sugyos he was learning. Just very quickly, just be able to see the structure in terms of shofar. So there's a famous Torah from the Rav, which the Brisker Rav also has, in terms of what the gather of the din of shofar is. So as just to go very quickly through this, the random halakhic data, we know that the Gemara Hashanah says that the shape of the shofar is reflective of the posture of a person during tefillah, either curved or straight. we know that the shofar is integrated into the Musaf Tefillah, and different Rishonim have different formulations as to what that is. We know that the lashon of the bracha of Zochronos is the chasimus of the bracha is Shomea Kol Tefillas Amor Yisrael Umazin Shura. Hashem listens to our tefillos and he listens to the Shura. And there are six or seven different rayos, different halachic facts that the Rav puts together to show that the halachic system treats shofar as a din tefillah. The shofar is not just an independent mitzvah like other mitzvahs are, like matzah, like lulav is a bad example, matzah like other mitzvahs, but the halacha treats shofar as a form of tefillah. Great. So that is the halachic construct which we just created based on all these different distinct halachic facts. Great. So the Brisker Rav stops over there. Shofar is a din tefillah, and that explains all of these phenomena. Rabbi Soloveitchik, if you start reading his writings about shofar, takes it to the next stage. He says, now that I know that there are two forms of tefillah, the halakha recognizes a form of tefillah through words, articulated words of tefillah. The halakha recognizes the fact that there's a certain tefillah which is just an animalistic sound, which is the sound of a shofar. What does that mean for me when I'm davening on Rosh Hashanah? What does that mean for me when I'm davening throughout the year? And he says this in several different places, in many different ways, but this is just from one topic lecture, Before Hashem You Will Be Purified, some of the Rav's drashos about Rosh Hashanah. He says the close relationship, source number 11, between prayer and shofar is reflected in how one should approach the act of prayer itself. The kim shevaleh of prayer rests on absolute dependence of man on the Creator. As such, prayer is not an exclusively... prayer is normally associated with speech. The one attribute which differentiates man from other life forms. Via prayer, man represents himself, utilizing the very attribute which attests to his greatness. Man stands before the Creator and engages in conversation in accord with the verse. A prayer of the afflicted when he faints and pours out his plaint, sikho, literally his conversation before God. Man, with his capability of achieving prophecy, engages Hashem in dialogue through verbal prayer. Right? Shimon Esrei is beautiful, it's articulate, it's poetic, it's structured. It's saying, God, you created me with amazing mental capabilities. I'm going to use that to daven to you. Yet, not only man engages in prayer. Hear a prayer, unto you all flesh will come. All living creatures engage in this activity, instinctively pouring out their needs to God. The mystics consider the chirping of the birds and the cry of the jackals, instinctive sounds, uniting them in prayer to their maker. When a Jew prays, he must identify himself not only as the very crown of creation who can express himself verbally, but at the same time, the simple life form with the mundane but very real physical needs. For the Jew, the wordless cry expresses itself best in the sound of the shofar, hence the halachic link between shofar and prayer. Which of these two aspects of prayer is man engaged first, will formulated verbal prayer or instinctive nonverbal prayer? The Rosh Hashanah service, in which Malkiyos, Zochronos, and Shofar sections are recited respectively, each subsequently followed by the shofar blast, clearly indicates that the verbal precedes the nonverbal. The sequence reflects a frustration with the inadequacy of verbal prayer. And this is probably a Torah which many of us have heard from the Rav, that you come before God in Rosh Hashanah, you try to use your words to explain your situation to Hashem. You try to explain, God, you created me in this and this way, I need this and this and this, and you try to explain to God through your beautiful poetic language that exactly what you need, and all of a sudden you feel that it's not adequate. You feel frustration. You feel like you're just lost. You feel like you can't fully express to God what you want, what you need to help you the next year. And how does that express itself? Through the animalistic primal cry of the shofar, the other form of tefillah. God, I'm giving up. I can't use my faculties to express myself fully to you, so I'm just going to cry out to you like an animal. And that is Jewish philosophy to a degree. It's describing what shofar is supposed to be about. It's describing the feelings we're supposed to feel when the shofar is being blown. Yet what's it all based on? It's based on lamdos. It's based on the fact that halakhically speaking, a shofar is a gather of tefillah. And all that is proven from the sugyos themselves, from these little bits of halakhic data. So you see the structure that the Rav is setting up over here. Starting off learning the sugyos from Rosh Hashanah, going from there to the halakhic construct, shofar equals tefillah, asking the next question, what does the fact that shofar equals tefillah mean for me when I'm davening Rosh Hashanah? Describing his experiences davening on Rosh Hashanah, oscillating between these two poles of as a human being capable of discussing something with God, to feeling inadequate like an animal, just crying out to God in need. So, and we'll see throughout the semester that Rabbi Soloveitchik is going to be doing this over and over and over again. Just to note, it's new in the sense that it wasn't done before, so to speak, it is systematically, but it's the most conservative way of doing Jewish philosophy because everything is rooted in a halachic source. Thank you so much. I hope everybody has a great day.